Right, well, Rich O'Brien, it's good to chat with you today, and I know I've caught up with you having just come off a kind of a bout of illness, having been to a hockey game, so you tell me.
Yeah, it was rather interesting. Something you get here in Somerville, South Carolina, here in the summertime, and work through there. You go from the air conditioning to the hot conditions there, and then the ice. And well, I'm allergic to cold weather. I guess I proved it, and wound up with some pneumonia. Lasted a couple of weeks here, but got some major events coming up at the end of the month. So hopefully, we'll be back to full strength for that.
Excellent. Well, Rich, I've been trying to catch up with you for a little while because I've read some of the stories about yourself and I've read some of your work. I know that you're pretty active and you write quite a lot on LinkedIn, and you have a lot of your articles that go in the news magazines, or certainly the golf magazines, I should say, in the States. But I'd really like to try and get a bit of a background on who is Rich O'Brien? Where are you from? How did you get started into golf? And sort of who was it that first exposed you to the game?
Well, I'm originally from Syracuse, New York, and hence I'm allergic to cold weather. But, my uncle, Howie, introduced me to the game of golf. He lived down in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And we went down for a visit there. He taught us a few things there. He was a very avid golfer himself. And instilled a passion for the game, I think, a love for the game. And that was a good thing. I was fortunate that my backyard, it was an acre and a half, and then there was three or other acres attached to it. So neighbors had no problem with us hitting golf balls back and forth around the back area there. You know, we stayed out of trouble. Passion so much in the afternoon for it that we'd love to go out and hit golf balls, and went from there. But taught myself how to play by and large. And by the age of 14, I was about a 2 handicap. Graduated, went to the University of Miami, walked onto the team down at Miami, and played on some teams that had some great players down there in Miami, and learned a lot. Never quite could crack the lineup, but had some great coaching. And by the time I graduated, I was a scratch or a slightly plus handicap at that point, and gave a go at it, trying to play professionally. But as we all kind of know that try to do that, that don't quite make it, there's always somebody better than you out there. And that was part of that. And but my degree was in sports psychology and exercise science from the University of Miami. So natural for me to get into coaching. So that's the area I went into, and worked at the University of Miami as an assistant coach, and then eventually got a head coaching job for golf at Barry University and built that program. So kind of an interesting arc along those lines, but passion for the game is always an important part of that. And imparting knowledge and teaching the learning theories that we learned in college to help players of all ability levels improve.
So tell me about those first recollections that you've got of golf. I mean, it's obviously pretty cool to be going out the backyard there and hitting some golf balls, but obviously there would be a first time for everybody, there always is, when they go to the golf course. And what were you, do you have any recollections of that, where you played and the feeling that golf gave to you at that time?
Yeah, I remember that fondly on there. We a couple weeks after coming back from my uncle's house there with clubs in hand, we went out to a course called Camillus Country Club out in Syracuse, New York. And very hilly golf course, a mountain goat golf course on there, but wide open from that extent. I was hitting the ball a long way for a 12-year-old at the time. And the feeling of a golf ball hit perfectly on a golf club, you know, that feeling's unlike anything else. And that really creates a lifelong passion to that extent. And I fell in love with the game immediately at that point. And the first time I played, I shot about 105. But the second time I played, I was under 100. So it was a quick love affair at that point, I think.
And you said that you got into psychology. Now, was that something that interested you around your own personal development in golf, or was that just something as a general kind of subject?
Well, you know, I knew when I was in high school that I wanted to study sports psychology and work from there as being a golfer and working through, because I thought it would give me an added advantage playing against opponents as well. I thought it would be a great knowledge base for me to maximize my own ability level. So I learned it to help myself primarily, but you know, from a standpoint of being able to give those lessons that I learned and transfer them to students has always been a beneficial thing as well.
Right. I mean, I remember when I was growing up and I was playing a little bit, I was reading golf books, and there was very few about the way that you thought about the game. I remember one particular book, Mind Over Matter. And so there was plenty of books about sports psychology, but there was very, very little about golf psychology. So when you started to study psychology, how did you see the natural application of some of that information? Did you see it into yourself, I think, which you've already alluded to, but also did you see how that could help other people?
Definitely from a standpoint, and it even went later on, I learned it went well beyond that, even to the extent that, you know, I'll get to that in a second, but, you know, from the standpoint, you know, at the time I was studying in college, I went to the University of Miami 84 to 88. That's when Dick Koop and Bob Rotella came out with their original works from that standpoint. And then Bob Rotella continued on with his groundbreaking work as well and working through. And with the audio books that he had, I found those would be very helpful for my college teams. That we would have that set and they would listen to them in their cars to and from the golf course each day. And over the course of a semester or a year, they would listen to the audio books, you know, numbers of times throughout and working through. And those lessons continuously were absorbed and went through along those lines. And as a coach as well, I put together a series as well with a lot of questions and a guided study that I would guide my players through, that I would meet with them on a monthly basis to discuss the sports psych elements of that there and how they would improve and their goals going forward. So that was always very helpful for my students and to discuss those and the lessons that they could be directly applied onto the golf course is one of the gifts, I think, that Bob Rotella has in his presentation. But then on top of that, after I became injured myself and I got into the adaptive golf field as well, a lot of the materials in the Rotella audiobooks is like getting counseling and life coaching for individuals that may never have gone to counseling in the first place. But because it's in a golf setting, those lessons could be then transferred to their own lives and improve the quality of their life.
Right. And it almost seemed like it was acceptable as well, which perhaps it was a little less acceptable, certainly over on this side of the pond. So if you kind of had a little bit of an issue with your golf, it was not normal, but it was a little bit more acceptable to go and see somebody about that. Whereas perhaps if you had a little bit of an issue in your life, maybe it wasn't seen as being quite so acceptable. So
the stigma of mental illness and challenges along those lines there, you know, I don't think we've done a service to ourselves with the way that others may perceive that somebody has a mental challenge and work through that way. It's really been unfortunate, you know, as somebody that has an unseen injury myself with post-traumatic stress and other issues along those lines. You know, it's an interesting challenge, but, you know, if we're able to cope with these, that's a good thing.
Absolutely. Just before I get to your accident, can you fill me in a little bit about what happened immediately after leaving college? Because clearly you were good enough to walk onto that team or into that college. And then for a little while, then you did a few different things that moved you eventually to getting into coaching in college. So can you fill me in a little bit in that period?
Well, you know, I worked the golf courses to try and basically pay for my golf habit. I caddied on the senior tour for a little while.
I love that term. Sorry, I love that term, golf habit.
Yeah.
Like an addiction, well, yeah? You know,
it is an addiction, definitely, from that standpoint, and work through. And as you try and improve and work through, I was fortunate that I caddied for Ed Fergal on the senior tour for a little while. And he basically, with the money that I made doing that, he helped fund my golf dreams, trying to go, you know, qualify and work through there. You know, play mini tours is an expensive proposition. It's an expensive lesson that you learn throughout the week. You're not really going to make a lot of money, even if you, you know, finish in the top three or four. You're barely breaking even or making a slight profit. So you're really paying for experience and working through that side of it. I was fortunate to have some sponsors that helped me try and go through a qualifying schools and work through that way. But never could quite crest the hump there and get over the top of the hill and get it set. And as I said, you know, there's always somebody out there that's better than you are, no matter how good you think you are. And if you don't have a great week on that week that it's required, you're going to wait a whole year back in those days, because back then it was before the qualifying process was the year long set up right now on the tours. And you have all those events to get enough money to qualify through and get the points that way there. Back then it was, you know, you go through the Q school. If you don't make the number, then you're back to the start square one. So real interesting challenge there that those of us that are 50 years old or so understand a little better than those that are 40.
So then you got into coaching at college. So how did that come about?
I actually in high school, I had seven coaches in 7 years on there. And it was kind of frustrating to a certain extent to that way there. We had some really good players on our team. We had the number one girl in New York State at the time. We had one of the top five boys at the time. And then I was like 20th or 30th. You know, as a senior, I went, well, you know, the three of us could coach this team and we could make basically all the decisions rather than having a rotating door. So we wound up getting the principal of the school as our coach and worked that way there. And he basically loved to golf and everything and worked through, but he basically drove the bus for us and let us organize what we needed to get done and put his stamp of approval on it. And that was good. So I actually got my feet wet coaching as a senior in high school, and fell in love with sports psychology then and performance enhancement working along those lines. So, you know, then I went to the University of Miami. I had Norm Parsons as our coach there. He was a 5-time women's coach before taking over the men's job there. One of the greatest guys I've ever met along those lines, a Hall of Fame coach for college golf, a great mentor working through. And I was helping him with various things, keeping team stats, working along those lines, helping with the fundraiser. Then when I graduated, I was a volunteer assistant for Chuck Winship, who was his successor at that point, another Hall of Fame coach. I learned the ropes of coaching college golf through them, which was really a good element. The ideas of how to build a program, fundraising, you know, improving the team's performance, of course, having all my sports psych element. And my other area of expertise was game improvement on the short game. And I developed some tools for the short game and for short game improvement on there as well, which I actually wound up working with some LPGA Tour players eventually on that, so, and helping them with their short game and putting.
Excellent. I mean, it's clearly you've had golf front and center one way or another in pretty much all of your life up to that point. And then I'll come back to that in a little while, but I want to take you to a very special day, September the 25th, 2008. So you're in Kiawah Island, where they played the Ryder Cup 1 year, not that long ago. The war on the shore, they called it at that time. You're riding your golf cart when your life changed very quickly and very dramatically. So can you tell me about the hours leading up to that eventful moment and what happened at 5:27 p.m.?
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing. Luckily, I celebrate my survival at this point, Tony. Sometimes someone who has a traumatic injury, you got to be a little careful a little bit about triggering post-traumatic stress, but I've talked about it enough that I'm good on this point. But from an aspect there, we were finishing up. It was a member guest event down at Cacique at the Kiowa Island Club, and we were coming in and we finished up on the third green after a short shotgun start, and it was raining that particular day, and a challenging day all day long out there. We played 27 holes that day, worked through and on that, and damp, wet. Everybody wanted to get in the clubhouse a little bit, and this low country doesn't really have a lot of hills, but this particular golf course, Cacique, has a feature called Mount Watson, and it's on the third hole out there. And to come back from the third green, you got to go over the top of Mount Watson on the way back to the clubhouse. And it's about 75 to 80 feet of elevation, which may not seem like much, but when you go from sea level to 80 feet of elevation, then back down to sea level in like a quarter mile, or a little less than a quarter mile, it does tend to get a little steeper. And this particular hill, as I said, it does a double switchback hill with an S turn. The cart paths were kind of designed to go up the hill rather than down. So it was sort of like a roller coaster at that point. So as we hit the top of the hill, start down the hill, the golf cart, you know, the driver of the golf cart wasn't, you know, driving anything faster than normal, just picks up a little speed going down the hill. As it turns hard left at the bottom, unfortunately, I go hard right out of the golf cart and off the golf cart from there. And there was a 2-inch curb at the corner of the cart path. And as I was falling down, the simulation estimated that I probably saw my right shoulder, saw my neck going in. So I threw my right shoulder underneath and slammed into the cart path with my shoulder, cracked my shoulder in half, tore up my rotator cuffs, tore up my labrum. But what happened at that point there was my head and neck snapped back, and there was a 2-inch curb at the corner of the cart path, and that's what struck the curb. So I broke my neck and broke my back in two places there. I had 4 skull fractures. I had brain damage in every lobe of my brain, multiple strokes, multiple aneurysms, and an epidural hematoma the size of a grapefruit on my cerebellum. So within a short period of time, there was so much blood in my brain that I was having convulsive seizures. And, you know, with a broken neck and a broken back, you know, 4 spinal fractures, having seizures is not a good situation. And I'm told that I died a few times at the scene, turned gray, then purple, then blue from that aspect there. So no oxygen for a brain for 4.5 minutes, kind of a tough one, too, to work from there. But luckily, there was a EMT that worked at the golf course, and within 5 minutes, I believe, of the time of the accident, he arrived at the scene, took charge, cradled my neck, got me breathing again, working through there. The EMS group there that was stationed on Keo Island got there as well. They made the decision that in order to save my life and my brain, they had to put me in a coma, and they had to give me a paralytic so my seizures wouldn't paralyze me from that aspect. And then they airlifted me to the local trauma hospital here in Charleston. So kind of a traumatic event there and everything, but I'm thankful to have survived.
Well, it certainly was, and you've raised a whole bunch of questions there for me. I mean, one of them is, do you know the EMT? Because he obviously, or that EMT was bang on the scene at the right time, I guess.
EMT, you definitely, Paul Tamidia is his name, and I've seen Paul a number of times since then, that everything, and I give him a big hug every time, because, you know, without him, I'm a paralyzed vegetable at best, and likely buried or burned otherwise. So you know, that's the, that element. I do need to go back out. I'm planning to make another visit out to the fire station out there at Kiawah Island as well, to thank them again on the 10th anniversary, shortly after the 10th anniversary as well.
I'd like to go into the recovery, because I think this is where, I mean, obviously everything that you've said up to now has been very interesting, but I think there's so many lessons that have, that we can learn from the way that you've recovered. And you've written extensively about the time that was immediately following your accident and how over the following year you set a goal to walk, I think I'm right in saying, 1,000 miles and to play golf again. And so could you, well, you can step me through, you know, just one more step on that, that path through some of those miles and explain the obstacles that you had to overcome in that, that first year of recovery.
Yeah, well, as I said, you know, on my deathbed, I knew I needed some powerful motivators to make get through and work there. I set the goal of walking 1,000 miles, because a journey of 1,000 miles begins with the first step, and mine was for overcoming, you know, paralysis after a very bruised spinal cord, working from there, and then also to play golf again. I didn't care how long it took and how much pain I had to endure. My love for the game of golf was so strong that I wanted to be able to hit golf balls again, because inherently, I think I knew that at the time, golf was a great form of therapy. And that was part of that. So, you know, the first steps I took, you know, I had to learn and walk and talk again at the rehab hospital, and worked through. And I still didn't understand the language. You know, it took me a while to understand everybody, because, you know, I lost every word of the English language, Spanish language, and Latin in a millisecond. And I learned how to speak again. I learned how to every word of the vocabulary by losing 1,000 games with words with friends with my sister. Mm-hmm. She was very patient on that one there, but I looked up every word. So that was a fun element on how to go. And now I'm a writer, figure that one out. So kind of an interesting combination. But the steps coming out, you know, my physical therapists at the hospital were amazed at my progress and my drive working through, and how hard I was willing to work. I literally did thousands of hours of rehab that first year. What I would wind up doing is I would wake up at about 5 a.m. every day. I would be in pain. So what I would wind up doing is, rather than staying in bed and being in pain, I'd get up and get active. I had a hot tub, so I'd go for 25 minutes or so in the hot tub. Excuse me. Then I would go take a hot and cold shower. This hot and cold shower would be an anti-inflammatory shower pointed to the locations where it was in pain, working through that. So cycling between the hot and cold to make that work. And then, you know, I'd have a cup of coffee, then get dressed and go walk. I would walk an hour a morning to see how far I could go each day. And I tracked that continuously as I went through. You know, starting out, I could only walk a couple hundred feet or 100 yards or so. Then every day I'd drive myself to go a little farther and force myself to go a little bit farther and a little bit faster. Found out that because exercise produces endorphins, that when I walked and when I produced the endorphins, I had a little bit of a pain-killing effect. So that was a good combination where everything, but you know, at the time I'm addicted to pain meds because, you know, I'm sensitive to pain meds starting through, and every day I'd be taking, you know, thousands of milligrams of painkillers working through there. You know, I had some episodes where I wound up having vertigo, that kicked in, about 2.5 months, I guess, after the accident, in the middle of right around Thanksgiving of 2008. And I'd start having a lot of neurological issues when I'd get exhausted, where I'd have tremors and working through that. You know, they wound up doing a ton of neurological testing on me and figured out I had ataxia and other issues with the cerebellum that worked through there from the accident working through. So we were cognizant and aware at all times of my energy levels. I learned to monitor that very well, learned to go up to my limit, but not over my limit. Because if I did, I'd have an episode that I would call very similar to Parkinson's disease, where I would literally freeze. I could not move. And when I could not move, my brain would still be there and I could talk and do everything and calm people down. They're seeing a statue sitting there and then I'd be okay. But it would take like 10 or 15 minutes for me to be able to move again. And I knew at that point there that I'd gone too far, that I needed to go immediately and sleep for the better part of a day in order to recharge my brain from that side of it there. After a brain injury, you basically need 12 hours of sleep. I've been told by doctors, some major neurological doctors, that in order to reboot the brain at that point, you might need 12 hours of sleep until it reboots. And it took me better part of 6 or 8 months of sleeping 12 hours a day for that to happen. To get through. So there's a lot of challenges working through. You know, I had my shoulder surgery. They couldn't operate on my right shoulder for 6 months because the extensiveness of my brain injury. They couldn't put me under anesthesia supposedly at that point. So imagine having a collarbone fractured in half, 3 rotator cuff tears and a torn labrum, your arm in a sling for an entire 6 months waiting for this here, your addiction to pain meds getting worse going through on that. And then finally the shoulder surgery, your shoulder in order for it to heal would have to be in a sling for 3 more months. So my shoulder wound up being in a sling for a year, or just short of a full year. And it was the worst frozen shoulder in the history of South Carolina. Is what my physical therapist called it later on. They pounded on it for a long time, working through there, trying to get the scar tissue out. But that was, you know, rather challenging at that point, painful. I actually, in our book, Half Paralyzed, Twice Strong, told my physical therapist that I would give them extra credit in their book if they made me cry, because I knew it was necessary to break the scar tissue up so that I could eventually play golf again. And they made me cry one time during that time period on there. But eventually they did a right shoulder manipulation under anesthesia and ripped the scar tissue out when I was out under anesthesia. And within a week of that, once I got the feeling back in my arm, I was able to start swinging a golf club. And that was an amazing thing at that point. And I'm sitting out there a couple weeks before the anniversary of my accident. I'm approaching 1,000 miles. I figured out the week before the anniversary, I was at 960 miles. And I was walking about 40 miles a week at that point as well. And I was now swinging a golf club. So I called up my pastor and said, Pastor Brian, would you like to go play 9 holes of golf with me to celebrate the 1-year anniversary of my accident? And at 5:27 p.m. on September 25th, 2009, the 1-year anniversary to the minute of my death, we finished the 9th hole at Somerville Country Club here, where I'm at, and finished the 1,000th mile on the 9th green, no less. And the two of us said a wonderful prayer of thanksgiving on how far I'd come at that point there on my road to recovery. But I still knew I had a long way to go in order to get fully healed and fully recovered. Kind of an interesting odyssey, is it not?
I'm sure that was quite a moment on that 9th green. And to share that with obviously people that you wanted to be around as well would be fantastic. But I mean, that was the start, as you mentioned. You certainly had to go further than that, and you did, and you made an incredible recovery. And I understand that you reached scratch again. And so I guess that
plus one, no less.
Okay, sorry, got it wrong. So plus one. So of all the things that you've learned from this achievement, and it is an achievement, it's a great achievement, Are there two or three takeaways that you think others might be able to learn from? And that's not, I'm not talking specifically about golf here now. I'm talking about that journey from death, as you mentioned on the 25th of September 2008, to where you are today, because golf is still very much part of your life.
Well, absolutely. And you know, the golf therapy forum that I created, is designed to encourage individuals that have injuries, illnesses, or challenges. We talk about using golf as a form of therapy to overcome injuries, illnesses, or challenges, but the forum itself is perfect for anybody that has a challenge of any type and working through there. And one of the things I found with post-traumatic stress, which is a huge problem that millions of people have, is we can either be a magnet of positivity or negativity. Those with post-traumatic stress are drawn either to the positive or negative. And from a standpoint, I try to be that strong magnet of positivity and showing the good side of things, because when people see the good side, they're drawn positive, they're thinking positively. If you have somebody that's complaining and negative and working through on that side of it, they may attract people on the negative side and make them feel worse. So I think positivity has been my biggest takeaway from recovering from a standpoint. You know, I've got an attitude of gratitude, obviously, on recovering. And I think, you know, then and now there are tens of thousands of people that tune into my stuff on a regular basis to get a dose of positivity, shall we say, and start their day off on a good note and see the good side of things. So that's one of the big ones. The other side, you know, as I said, you know, we can use recreation and other activities such as golf to reintegrate people into society. You know, we've got, for post-traumatic stress, again, one of the biggest things that we have is individuals separate themselves. They're recluses and working on that. You know, they don't have anybody that else has the experience of post-traumatic stress, so they separate themselves that way. Golf and other recreational activities enable them to have a common interest, learning a new skill, working along those sides of it there, that's very helpful. And if you have caring individuals that are coordinating programs, such as a PGA professional through our PGA Hope programs and other adaptive golf programs, you know, that's a great way to facilitate it. But it's primarily the individuals talking among themselves that have a shared experience working through. And you know, the golf as a vehicle for that is a great social game. So that's a good side of it. And then overcoming injuries, you know, it takes a lot of determination. You know, you have to be focused. You have to have a game plan. Like, I had a game plan for my recovery where, as I said, I would get up every morning, a hot tub, the hot and cold shower, the walking, working there, building up endorphins, meditating later on. You know, I'd literally spend 3 or 4 hours every single morning, so I'd have two or three hours of relative clarity without pain medication, blocking all of my memories and just shutting me down when the afternoon kicked in. So, mm-hmm. You know, there was a lot of things involved there. Breaking that down. And the other thing is pain medication. You know, the pain medications blocked memory for me. You know, when I have these pain pills, I had to write everything down in a notebook. If I didn't, it would be gone within a few minutes. And then, you know, as I finally, with the scalp acupuncture and the, I didn't include scalp acupuncture in there, but scalp acupuncture helped me reboot my central nervous system, got rid of my pain. That can certainly help a lot of people at that point there that are suffering from chronic pain, from chronic inflammation, chronic fatigue, chronic sleep disorder, epilepsy, addiction to pain meds, post-traumatic stress. Those were the conditions I had that acupuncture helped me with. So that I think acupuncture might be the other main takeaway there, Tony.
I mean, clearly you've gone through a fair amount to understand how you could improve. And obviously there's some real benefits there for other people to learn from that. And you've become quite a prolific writer. So how and why, or maybe the other way around, why and how did you start to get involved in writing?
Well, you know, it was interesting. You know, I was a marketing director and a college coach. I'd written, you know, in college, I wrote a program for my team called the Player Improvement Handbook. So, I wrote on that side of it, talking about sports psychology and golf side of it. So I had, you know, I was able to communicate fairly well along those lines. And then you have an accident and she's being, but you know, I was marketing director as well for some clubs. So I had to write those sort of articles. I was always very good with words and working on that side of it. But then you have an accident, you got to learn every word again. It's kind of a challenge, but, it seems like with my injury, the strongest sense became my visual cortex or my visual sense. And in order to understand something, I had to visualize something completely and get the big picture of it. And once I had the big picture of it, I could just describe it in vivid detail. And if you've read my materials, you understand that I very, very, you know, image friendly from that standpoint, where you know you can see it from that standpoint. You might feel the emotions that the people I'm writing about on there. So it was interesting. I started writing my own story after my own accident, and keeping notes and working through, even though you know it was a challenge at that point with a brain injury and the pain meds to get anything. I had to write it immediately down, working through and work with little snippets. Finally, when I got done with my pain, my chronic pain, a lot of the memories started flooding back and working through, so I could write a little bit more. But it was at that time that my friend Fred Gutierrez, the partially paralyzed golfer here in Somerville, that goes to my church, he asked me if I'd teach him how to play golf because he had watched me recover. And it was like, okay, I'll help you any way I can. And it became one of the great stories. You know, Golf Channel called our story the most inspirational golf story in 40 years, working from there. Al Taze, the editor of Golf Channel's .com there, he great writer from there, former editor of Golf World magazine, and he became one of our biggest fans. He read our book and went wow. He covered our story, but the partially paralyzed golfer story. Then PGA Hope saw the story on Golf Channel, and they asked us to champion the PGA Hope program here in Charleston. So it just keeps cycling up, and you know, I wrote the book Half Paralyzed, Twice Strong, to chronicle what, you know, on my recovery and Fred's recovery working through, because there was a lot of lessons learned on our road to recovery that could help others with strokes, with chronic pain, with PTSD. And that was very helpful along those lines. And then, you know, it just became a habit to write golf therapy stories, talking about other people that overcome challenges and telling their stories to encourage others. So that's what I started doing.
Tell me a little bit about PTSD, because I think it's generally misunderstood by the layman. So can you tell me a little bit about how it is and how it affects you and how it has affected you?
Well, you know, post-traumatic stress, it's exactly what it sounds like. You know, you have a traumatic incident. You know, you wind up, that memory becomes embedded in your brain. You have nightmares and flashbacks that constantly remind you of it, whether, you know, you might have a reminder of a sense of smell or a sound, or you see something. Or combining that way there, it's a challenging thing, and you know it changes the way the brain is organized to a certain extent along there. It's anxiety, it becomes fear, and working through along those lines. And for me, you know, my post-traumatic stress was waking up paralyzed from the neck down, unable to speak when I first woke up from my coma. So that was about September 29th, 2008 there. And that indelible memory was imprinted on my brain. And each day for about 3.5 years, that memory would be at the forefront. And I would probably have it 4 or 5 times a day on average working through. And it would be a paralyzing fear, literally, at that point, and very hard. Your brain does not think clearly in that time period. You become depressed quite a bit there. And one of the reasons why I walked every single day, you know, I'm approaching 20,000 miles right now since that accident 10 years ago and learning how to walk. You know, I walked every single day as a reminder that I was not paralyzed. So, you know, that was one of my tools there. Mm-hmm. But it was interesting. But, you know, people misunderstand post-traumatic stress. They may think that it's a military disorder or a military thing where you get shell shock from a military service. That is one of the more common causes of post-traumatic stress. But you also have police and fire. That they, you know, the emergency responders, they often see and do things that cause indelible memories for them as well. You've got individuals that have been raped, definitely an indelible memory there. Somebody that's been in a traumatic accident or saw some traumatic events there that could lead to an indelible memory. You know, it's somebody that has a traumatic event, and you're not going to have everybody develop post-traumatic stress, but it's commonality. You know, about 20% of the veterans in our country, in the United States, coming back from Afghanistan right now, they experience post-traumatic stress. It's like 15 to 18% in Iraq as well, and others. And military service certainly is a big cause of it. You know, it's not anything about the strength or weakness of an individual. It's just, you know, those memories are hard to shake at that point there and work on that. And they cause indecisiveness. They cause, you know, depression, escapism. A lot of individuals with post-traumatic stress, they're going to drugs or alcohol to try and forget, to fall asleep, to work through. So there's a lot of covariant habits that happen from that standpoint as well, that try to escape reality.
I guess the question is this something that you've been able to wipe, or is it something that's always there? You're aware of it, but you cope. What I suppose it's a difference between wiping it out of your mind or coping with it and putting it where it should be, putting it away in a place that you know it's there, but you deal with it.
Right. And, you know, I'm always going to have post-traumatic stress. You know, there's no way to shake it. You can't eliminate it completely. You can, however, minimize the effects of it, as is what I've been trying to do. I developed a number of strategies. Like I talked, the strenuous mm-hmm. exercise was my first strategy for helping me reduce my post-traumatic stress. I would wind up being exhausted, and getting exhausted, I would sleep a little bit better. But part of post-traumatic stress, it messes up your delta wave issue. You never get to get into REM sleep. So that's one of the elements of post-traumatic stress that makes it so bad. You never get restorative sleep. Makes chronic pain worse and everything along there that goes with that. My second tool in my kit was golf as therapy. Mm-hmm. You know, playing golf for me was therapy. I would combine exercise with hitting a golf ball there and the social elements of the game. So that was another tool in my toolkit. My third tool in my toolkit wound up being acupuncture. The acupuncture treatment is a 6-needle treatment that goes in the ears, and I would get once a week for me starting out from there, and I would drain away the negative energy. For me, it would last 3 or 4 days starting out, then it went up to 6 days, 7 days that I could do that. And if I went to acupuncture every week for that period of time, it would drain away that element. And then I also wound up helping to develop a pair of focus glasses that allowed me to block out the white noise around it, because post-traumatic stress, we hear and see everything and work through that way. So these glasses had thin slits about the pupil level, and that would block out a lot of the white noise, and I could concentrate better. So if I'm using the computer or doing some of that, I would wind up having these glasses on for that period of time, and I could focus better, and that was a good thing.
Right. Tell me, I'm going to just ask, what have you learned about yourself through golf?
What have I learned about myself through golf? Oh, well, you know, having been a plus one handicap before my injury, and then learning how to get back to being a plus one handicap afterwards, a little bit older, a little bit wiser, shall we say, but, you know, working there. And I'm going to try and win a pair of long drive cup world championship coming up September 29th. On the 10th anniversary of waking up from my coma, I'm going to try to hit the ball over 300 yards in that. So, you know, what have I learned? I've learned that we can create power efficiently without hurting the body has been very good. And that's been one of my focuses there, because I can't swing more than 80 to 90%. Otherwise I will tear up my back and my neck. And we're working from that side of it there. What have I learned about myself? How mentally tough I am. You don't want to be in a tight match with me, because I died three times. and I'm mentally tough, let's put it that way. You know, I'm never going to quit, let's put it that way.
I mean, it's been fascinating chatting to you. And I've got a couple of kind of lightweight questions really here, but nevertheless, I think they're very revealing questions. So I guess the first one here is, if you could play a four ball with anyone, dead or alive, who would your three playing companions be and why?
Well, I would have Bobby Jones. I would thank my Uncle Howie, who introduced me to the game.
His fault. And then, it was his fault.
It was his fault. Yep. We can blame Howie Alexander for that. He was a World War II. He was in planes on that with some bombers there, and had to actually land some planes after pilots got hurt on there. But kind of an interesting combination. But he was. He was my inspiration, so that was good. And then, you know, Jack Nicklaus is one I would respect as well. Either that, or I would have. I may wind up having Fred Gutierrez playing with us, so he'd have a chance to play with my uncle and Bobby Jones.
We'd definitely allow you a five ball. It's okay. We'll do that. Tell me, if you could magically be with someone who had a similar accident to you, so you can frame this answer now as either just the moment that you actually hit your neck against the curbstone or immediately following it, what advice would you want to offer them?
Well, I've actually had the opportunity to mentor one of our veterans here in Charleston who had a head injury similar to mine. And I taught him how to focus. He was a good player, but you know, he had a lot of the issues associated with traumatic brain injury on there. And you know, we're able to help him learn how to focus and working through using my sports psych techniques and what I had done to help me. And his name is Eric Milland. And Eric, he participated in the United States Disabled Golf Open down in Orlando a few months ago. And Eric finished third in that event. But what was truly amazing at that event was he was 500 par the last 10 holes with two eagles and almost won it from behind and working through. And I've been working with Eric to help him throughout that time. So it's been interesting to put it into a real world perspective and have him be able to compete at that level But you know, it goes to show that you know, with acupuncture, with a focused trainings and other elements, working on the right things, that we can come back from truly catastrophic injuries. And one thing that I've worked with some of the profiles are other individuals with traumatic brain injuries, and how, you know, different recreational sports can be great therapy for everybody as building blocks and tools for building new skills that lead up to it. And golf is one of the more challenging ones that work through there, but you know, we can rebuild life skills through some recreational activities too. And with hard work, we can come back even from the biggest challenges. And I have some individuals with severe traumatic brain injuries that are working with us that we hope to get out for the Para Long Drive Cup in the next couple of years.
I've got a final question for you, which is, are there any goals or objectives that you have either for yourself in golf or for golf that you'd be prepared to share with us?
Well, you know, I think my biggest goal is Tony, I think it's something we share with disabled golf as well. You know, we've got 57 million people in the United States alone that have an injury, illness, or challenge. And my goal through my work with Golf Therapy and PGA Hope and Adaptive Golf has been to create an awareness really among the golf community of an opportunity to work with these individuals, to reintroduce them to the game of golf if they played golf before they were injured, or introduce them to the game if they never had, because golf can be a great form of therapy for them. It can also be a great outlet for them to face their challenge, give them a chance to compete again and work along those lines. And my goal for golf is to see more accessible carts available for golf courses for the millions that have mobility challenges. My goal is for golf courses to be more accessible and welcoming for individuals that have challenges, and to have members of clubs or people from there that will go out and play with new players and get them the golf course, so that other members of the club don't intimidate the new players or those with the challenges, because that will drive the individual away from the game because they don't feel welcome. You know, I think a welcoming attitude for the game of golf will go a long way, because imagine if 2 or 3 million more Americans started playing, and worldwide, you know, tens of millions perhaps worked that way there, just because the game of golf has a welcoming attitude and we embrace individuals with challenges and work that way. Because, you know, the game can be the greatest PR campaign the game has ever seen from an aspect of inclusion and diversity, as well as a feel good attitude that we're helping individuals improve the quality of their life. And that would be a huge goal for me going forward.
Well, I share your aspirations on that. And certainly it's without question, with 15% of the world disabled, which is according to the World mm-hmm. Health Organization, the number, that's a lot of new golfers in every country. And mm-hmm. I think as well that what we've seen is that when you put disabled golfers into golf club environments, it changes the golf club, and it changes it for the better, because all mm-hmm. of a sudden now there is an understanding of actually these people that we thought were previously just disabled people, we don't see them as disabled anymore. We just see them as buddies that we play golf with on a Saturday or a Sunday. And so it kind of gets rid of the stigma of disability. So yeah, I'm all in with you on raising the awareness and getting more people with disability playing the game, because no doubt about it, it will be a fantastic campaign for golf.
And the other side of it as well, as I think you agree totally, is, you know, we need to have more competitions available for them as well, because, you know, with European Disabled Golf Association leading the way, setting the model worldwide for what can be done and working through, we're trying to do some similar things here in South Carolina along those lines, and having competitive opportunities that side of it. We've got the infrastructure in place with the carts and the other equipment available accessible golf courses so that we're good host sites as well. So maybe we can collaborate on some more tournaments and make sure that golf and the Paralympics and having world championship level events available are a
goal. You've got some good people over there doing some really good work, and certainly things are moving on now on a worldwide scale. But yeah, plenty to do and lots of passionate people doing that work. So, watch this space, I guess. I just want to finish off with, if people would like to reach you, Rich, how would they find you?
Well, I'm easy to find on social media. It's Rich O'Brien Golf. It's O-B-R-I-E-N. And whether you want to go on LinkedIn, Instagram, Facebook, all the others on there, that's what that is. I'm prolific, as Tony mentioned, as far as writing. You look up Rich O'Brien Golf, you'll see hundreds of articles probably at that point there. Do a lot of my blog on LinkedIn, working from there, and then publish to other magazines. Editor of Long Drive Golf Magazine, so we give a platform to Para Long Drive there as well, but also cover the longest hitters in the game. So not hard to find, but if somebody is in the States from here in South Carolina, they can look me up. Happy to meet with them and do some different things along those lines as well. So.
Great. Well, Rich, it's been fascinating to chat to you. Thank you very much for your time. You can now get on with your day. And my days are beginning to come to a close, so it's certainly been good to chat with you, and I'm sure we'll be in contact in the future.
Sounds good, Tony. Thank you. Thank you for everything you've done as well.
You're welcome.